You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 121.
The writing is the only progress you make. Ernest Hemingway.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. Now, guys, today on the show, we have author and writer Jamie Nash, who is the author of Save the Cat Writes for TV, the last book on creating binge-watching content you'll ever need. And I have to say, after reading this book, I completely agree. If you're a fan of Save the Cat, which is the most popular, best-selling screenwriting book of all time, then you're going to love this book. Jamie goes deep into the step-by-step approach using Blake Schneider's principles. In this conversation, we talk about the 8 Save the Cat TV franchise types that will improve your story and your pitch, the not-so-secret TV pitch template, how to write and structure a compelling TV pilot that can launch both your series and your TV writing career, and much, much more. We also break down a ton of different TV pilots and discuss some of our favorite shows and why they are so amazing. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jamie Nash. I'd like to welcome to the show Jamie Nash, man. How you doing, Jamie?
I'm doing great.
Thanks for coming on the show, brother. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks. We're here to talk about your new book, Save the Cat Writes for TV. And I am a huge Save the Cat fan. I've had multiple different authors who've written different Save the Cat books on as well, because some people it's a formula and it doesn't, you know, it's like, oh, it's taking all the creativity out of it. And you know what? For some people, that might be the truth. But other people, it's not. So I always like to present every kind of system, way, structure that you can, because you just never know what writer's going to connect with what person. I remember when I read Save the Cat for the first time, I was just completely blown away. And I was just like, I was young, early in my screenwriting career. And there's a reason why it's still one of the best-selling, if not the best-selling.
It is the best-selling, by the way. My book can't even knock it off its perch. So, you know, we're number 2 a lot of times, staring right at it. And I'm like, can we pass it for one day?
And it's how old now? How long has that been around?
2007.
So it's been around for a couple years now. So there's obviously some sort of value there, because there's been a lot of screenwriting books between 2007 and now.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's still there. So how did you – I was reading a little bit before our conversation. You met Blake back in the day.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm in Maryland, and if you know, most of my career is spent doing indie horror movies, especially back in those days. And somewhere along the line, I was trying to network over the internet back in the, you know, the 2000 internet, like 2003, 2004 internet. And I remember I met him through a writing group. There was some kind of writing group. I can't remember how they met him, but he was there and he actually wanted me to write a script with him. He had seen that I had sold some stuff. I was just starting my career. And, he kind of came to me and said, you know, I like your sense of humor. You have a good, handle on structure. And, he had this idea for a script. And he pitched it to me and he was, even though his days were probably a few years before that, like the 90s were his heyday. You know, he sold, I think he had $2 million script sales. Of course, he infamously wrote Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. That's how he broke into Hollywood. So he hadn't, I'm not sure if he had sold anything in the last couple of years, but to make a long story short, he asked me to write a script with him and I met him that way. And that was prior to Save the Cat. And I mentioned this in the book. He was using the Save the Cat terms on me, and I just thought they were like standard Hollywood terms. Like he wasn't doing it in the way the book does it. He was just like, you know, we need an all is lost moment here, or we need a in the debate section. And he was using these terms, and I was like, oh, this is just the way, you know, maybe he just got this jargon through, you know, talking to producers and stuff right. like that. But I almost organically processed that stuff even before the book out, just through him talking through that kind of stuff. So that's how I met him.
That must have been pretty cool. And yeah, man, that must have been awesome coming up. But so how did you get into the business?
Yeah, so I was a computer science major. That's how I got into the business. Now, I was a computer science major. I always loved film. I was doing computer games at the time, but programming them, nothing really that creative. I always thought programming would lead me to the creative side. It never really did. It was a different kind of creativity. I was always like, yeah, and then one day I'll make my adventure game and I'll put my stories in there. And that never happened. So I wrote on the side. And probably in the early 2000s, I started to write screenplays. And the first one I sold a script called Altered with Eduardo Sanchez. It was Eduardo Sanchez, the, you know, your listeners will know the Blair Witch Project, one of the Blair Witch Project directors. Mm-hmm. And that was his first movie after Blair Witch. And Universal picked it up. And then Universal kind of buried it in some ways. It was a straight to DVD. Still to this day, people find it now. It came out, I think, 2006, 2007-ish. Mm-hmm. And people find it to this day and are like, I've never heard of this movie. It, you know, it has a lot of fans that just right. pick it up and find it and enjoy it. But that was my intro to the business. I made some good money. I kept programming because I was like, you know, it's not enough money. It's not going to change my programming ways. But then after that, made some more movies, got a lot of indie gigs. I was really this weird indie screenwriter. I was doing, and honestly, I think it was because I was cheap. I wasn't in the WGA yet. I wrote really fast. I was game for anything. I just loved to write and make movies. And I was, you know, when I compare myself to what I do today, what it taught me, because I did finally go full time. I went full time in 2008 when the market kind of crashed. Mm-hmm. And I got laid off from my Citigroup gig. And at the time, I was a computer consultant for Citigroup. Not that I was laid off. They were just like, we're not making any money. We're not going to hire any of you consultants back next year. You get paid too much. And at that point, I said, I'm going full time. And a couple years after that, so that's been since 2008, I've been a full-time screenwriter. And probably that's around crazy. In 2011, I finally got in the Writers Guild. The point I was going to make was when I was an indie writer, I had to write like 10 screenplays a year just to make a little bit of money to survive. Like I had to write so many screenplays and do so many gigs because I didn't have all those guild protections of minimum salary, residuals, all that stuff. And then once I got in the guild, my muscles were in a way that I was just used to writing 10 screenplays a year. So I'm kind of a nut in that I write about five to six scripts a year or something, pilots, television shows, podcasts. I'll write novels. And probably since that time, I've been doing it, screenwriting full time, but now in the WGA.
That's awesome, man. That's a you're a unicorn. You mean someone who's a full-time screenwriter? Like that's
I'm a full-time screenwriter, unicorn. And also I'm in Maryland, which makes it even weirder.
Right, exactly. And that's the thing that a lot of screenwriters listening think that the only way you can make a living is if you're Shane Black, Aaron Sorkin, or Tarantino, where you know you're getting million-dollar paydays. But there are, and I've had on the show many just workmen, craftsmen, just people, screenwriters who are just, you know, cranking out work, you know, job for job, you know, and making a good living and supporting their family, but they're just working as opposed to like this one and done lottery ticket mentality, which so many screenwriters get into the business with.
Yeah. I mean, your the title of your show, your podcast, that was my life. It was indie film hustle. I legitimately, I had to do 10 scripts a year because I don't know that I did 10. I'm using that number. It was more like five or something. You know?
It's still a lot.
It was crazy. And to this day, I get anxiety if I don't produce that many in a year. And it's basically, like you say, the Shane Blacks of the world, not even the Shane Blacks, but the LA folks, they have a different game they're playing where they have lots of meetings. They're networking every day. They live and breathe it. But for me, I'm constantly feeling the need to remind people I exist. And the way I do it is by writing. So I'm constantly saying, look, I'm here. I got a new thing. And I'm meeting people. Like after it goes out, then I meet people, talk to them. So that's my life.
So your networking technique is to actually create content and create projects.
Yes.
Wow, yes. what a concept! As opposed to just doing one script that took you 7 years to write, and hoping that that's the one that's going to break you.
Yeah, it's definitely. I'm not sure that everybody can pull it off, but it's the only way I've known to really pull it off. And then when you get one friend, that friend is where you get most of your work, to be honest. So yeah. Eduardo Sanchez is a good example. I did a lot of work with Nickelodeon. So the weird thing is I'm a horror person and a kid person. Like they're the two
opposite
biggest arenas. Yeah. So I've done tons of scripts with Nickelodeon and I did tons of horror scripts. Once you find that person that really wants to champion you and likes your work and sees it, then they become the majority of your stuff. But I've sold over the years. I mean, it's crazy all the different places because we had a script at Blumhouse at one point, which is obvious. But then I also had something at like Discovery. I had a pitch that I sold to Discovery at one point. I've had stuff at Amazon Prime, all over the place.
So that's awesome, man. That's awesome. So you sat down and wrote a book called Save the Cat Writes for TV. Yes. And right now, arguably television and when you say television, I use streaming. Is all encompassing television and streaming. It is probably the most lucrative and easy. I can't say easiest, but you have a better chance of making a living in the television streaming world than you do off of independent films only because it's. I mean, when you were coming up, independent films there was money to be made. Now it's a lot different world we live in. Now the money's in streaming. So that's why I wanted to have you on the show because I feel so many screenwriters who've been, you know, just hacking away at the independent film script, which is fine. And you can definitely keep doing that, are starting to transition. You're like, you know where I think streaming and television, I might want to start trying to get into the writer's room. I might start trying to develop my own show and all that kind of stuff. So first question I have for you is what are a few questions a writer needs to ask themselves when developing a show?
That's a great question. So I have this kind of magic formula in the book that it's the first section of the book. By the way, the book will take you from A to Z. And I should define what Z is super quick is because like you said, you put it perfectly. The number of jobs in the WGA, television to film, if you do the comparison, they do a report every year. And the last I saw, this isn't the exact numbers, but it's super close. It's ballpark. I should have looked up the exact numbers. Is I think of 9,000 jobs, 7,000 plus are in television.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's super skewed toward television. And it makes sense because they're writer's rooms and all these other things.
Right. So more jobs, just more jobs. More jobs.
Tons of streamers. Each show has, you know, 5 to 12 writers. They're in rooms. They get jobs. So, which is part of the reason why we did this book, why we did this Rights for Television book. So the thing my book really tries to push is the reason you write a television pilot. And it's really concerned with pilots. So that's what I said. A to Z. A, you start with nothing. Z, you end up with a pilot. When I say a pilot story, a save the cat outline, you know, you'll have the outline ready to go. All you have to do is get in final draft and crank out the fun stuff. A TV show pitch and a TV show concept. So you could pitch your show or you could send the pilot in. Either one would work. And so when a writer is considering doing television, what my pitch to you is, or to your listeners, is you need a pilot. A pilot is the key thing you're going to need, because really you're not – one goal is to sell the show. That is one goal. But if you want one of those TV writer's jobs, if you want to get in one of those rooms, right now they're asking for original scripts. So, you know, back in the day, and, you know, when I was coming up, they would ask you for spec scripts, which were like an episode of Friends, for example. You just write like episode 203 of Friends, you know. Nowadays, nobody wants that. And I, you know, I polled a lot of people just to make sure, because I considered putting that section in the book. And so I went out to my, you know, showrunner friends, my friends that are on staff, and they say nobody writes those anymore. There's some fellowships that actually take them. So it's not true. There are unicorns that still ask for them. There's like the one in 100 that say, we want to see your friend's script to decide if you're going to come in to writer's room. But most people are looking for pilots. Some will take features and some will take plays, but 99% of them take pilots. Like, pilots is what you need. So the book is really focused on the fact, hey, you might want to get one of those TV jobs. Hey, you might try to write a pilot. So that said, to kind of backtrack, to write a great pilot, you need a good show. So this is your question. So what are the things in a show that you really need? And from my experience and then from research as well, I came up with the three big things. These are the three. A unique world is really important. There are some like stand-up comics and stuff that their point of view is kind of the world, you know, like Seinfeld. It's a show about nothing, so to speak.
Yeah.
But his unique view of it, his comedy, is kind of the world. But for the most part, you're trying to find some kind of world that you know and that's authentic to you. Because, again, these are writer samples that you're trying to get a job with. So your script needs to say something about you. So it has to be something you love. Yeah, you know, in the book, I give examples of things I love. I love pro wrestling. You know, I love street performing. I love computer programming. You know, these are things I love and I could speak about. I could talk about. I love to research.
So can we do a pilot that is a pro wrestler who's also a street performer and codes on the side?
I've done it. I've gotten that.
I've got four of those pilots. I've got those four pilots.
Yeah, exactly. I've got all of this. The funny thing you say, here's the weird thing. I've done two of those worlds for pilots, but the programming one, which seems the most obvious and the most relatable, I haven't figured out a fun take on that yet.
Silicon Valley is a great, and it's not coding per se, but it was so wonderfully done. I mean, Silicon Valley was wonderfully done.
That's the thing between that and Halt and Catch Fire. I don't need to do. I'm a huge Halt and Catch Fire person, and I love Silicon Valley. So what am I going to add to that? I can't find the fresh perspective. One day I'll find it. So world is the first part. And then when I was going to pitch, the first thing you learn in television at every meeting, you'll pitch this great thing and they'll tell you, they'll sit you down, they'll say, we really care about his character, 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 character. It's all about character in television. It's who you want to invite onto your DVR every single week. It's all about character. And they always say to put character first. I have trouble. I'm a plot first guy. I'm kind of a concept first guy. You know, I came up, loving the Shane Black kind of stuff. You know, Die Hard is kind of my movie. So I'm a concept first type person. But I really had to, over the years, especially over the last, 6 years, I really kind of reinvented myself to try to think character first almost, or that's try to really get at what pulls at my heartstrings and what engages my own personal story and emotions in the script. So character is part two. And then the last one is, and this is another term I never heard until I got to Hollywood. The term was, somebody would say, what's the franchise? That would be the first question you'd get. And to me, it was a really cheesy kind of question, like a guy with a cigar would be, yeah, what's the franchise, kid, or something. But it was a term that was regularly used. And what it meant was story engine. What's the thing that if you put, you know, if you kind of sit there every week and you say, we need a story idea. What's the inspiration for it? What's the where does the conflict come from? Where do the goals? Where do the heroes come from? And it's that franchise. That's the thing. So in the book, just to give you an example for a franchise, I came up these, and Blake Snyder came up with these things called genres in his first book. And genres were basically story patterns. They were recurring stories we'd see over time. So he has like buddy love, might be buddy cop or romance. He had a Golden Fleece, which might be like a quest movie, or it might be a sports movie for, you know, you're trying to win the trophy. You're trying to win something. Monster in the House. That was my favorite.
Yeah. Fish out of water. I think it was something.
I do think he has a true fish out of water. He has a Full Triumphant as one that he has. So there are ones that kind of become fish out of water, but I don't think he has one. But he has a whole bunch. I'm trying to remember the number exactly. I think there's 10. There might be 12. I should know. They're in my book too. Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of them, and they were the stories. So I came up with something similar, which is the franchises. I kind of went through and I identified all the types of franchise types to help you figure out your show. You could probably come up with these, just like you came up with fish out of water. Like that's a recurring theme. TV shows, there's the procedural shows. I call those blank of the week. They're my blank of the week shows. So it could be anything from X-Files, you know, monster of the week, to CSI, which might be case of the week, to House, which might be patient of the week or something like that. So that's one type of franchise. Trapped Together. So they're your family shows. Or the office space shows. So you're in an office, you're trapped with these people around you. The conflict and the reoccurring stories come from those people and the interplay and the social dynamics. And so I came up with a bunch of these, much like he had genres. And the way I suggest, so there are the three things I think you come up with. Honestly, think you start with world, like what are the worlds you love? Then say, who are the characters that really compel you in those worlds? And make a big list. You know, in Silicon Valley, you know, you have the CEO, you have the guy who runs the incubator, you have all these things, and you write those down and you have all your characters. And then if you start applying to the franchise type, you know, is this a Trap Together? Is this a blank of the week? You know, and then you can kind of brainstorm the kind of show you're creating through those three main pillars that you're creating.
So we have a blank of the week, we have Trapped Together. Are there any other ones?
There are. So a lot of the modern serialized shows, so blank of the week, they're kind of the old, you know, episodics.
Right.
There's a dude with a series long problem or season long problem.
Breaking Bad?
Breaking Bad, or somebody that like 24 or something like that.
Right, right.
There's one called Man or Woman with a Plan. So it's somebody almost like the show Revenge. Remember the show Revenge? Or something where somebody's like they have a plan and they're going to enact it. There's Buddy Love. So some of these are similar to the genres because they tell stories over time.
And does this go from comedy to drama to action?
Absolutely. Okay. So much like the genres, the Blake Snyder genres, which are they're like cousins to these franchise types. a monster in the house, just as an example. So a monster in the house is usually like a person trapped in a scenario with some monster. But something like What About Bob or Cable Guy, they're not horror movies, but they're still patterns that are similar to Fatal Attraction or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, What About Bob? Yeah. So one of the examples I give in the book is dude or dudette with a series long problem or season long problem is The Good Place, and that's a comedy. Mm. But it could also be Homeland, or something like that. So they definitely cross genres. They're really just speaking to where you're going to find the conflict week to week, you know. And they help you kind of brainstorm what your show is. But they also help you brainstorm what your pilot will be, and they also help you brainstorm what the season might look like.
Gotcha. And obviously, so like the procedural, like, you know, blank of the week, that is more network television kind of world. That's not as much the streamers. I mean, of course, there's always crossover.
There's always exceptions. The one place you might see it in the streamers is animation. When you get the animation, some of those are like Rick and Morty or something like that. they can be serialized for sure. I mean, Rick and Morty isn't a streamer, but they have a Big Mouth or, you know, some shows like that. Maybe no, not so, BoJack.
South Park, but that's Comedy Central.
No, yeah. South Park's a good example. Again, it's network, but it's kind of streaming too.
Right, exactly. But, when I say network, it's the four big ones. That's what I'm thinking, like, is NBC, ABC,
like
CBS, and Fox.
Theory or, you know, something like that. They're definitely those procedurals, those television, like Hawaii Five-0, you know, things like that. They're definitely in the blank of the week category, or even the trap together category.
Yeah, and that's the one thing I've never seen a Hawaii Five-0 or CSI in a streamer world. It doesn't really exist. Originals, obviously, after the fact, but never originals, because I've, because of the pandemic, have been consuming quite a good amount of television lately, and I finally went back to Handmaid's Tale. I hadn't finished it yet because I got pissed off when they caught her again. I was like, I can't take it.
That's how I was. I got to season two. I love season one.
Yeah,
it was fantastic. Season two. I'm like, this is great. And I was like, I can't. It's got to go forward somewhere. I can't take it.
And when they pulled her back out, I was like, I'm out. I can't. Yeah. But then they've got three seasons. So I got basically the third season. And then as of this recording, the fourth season starts, I think, Friday.
You and I are the exact same one. It's so funny.
I literally, when they pulled her out of spoiler alert.
Season one was like my favorite show when it was on. I loved it. I was like, this is great. And then season two, I'm like, I still love it. And then once it got to the end, I was like, I don't know if I want to watch season three.
I can't. And just a perfect example, Walking Dead. Like Walking Dead, I was a huge Walking Dead fan.
So me are the same. Yeah.
And once Negan showed up.
Right.
Negan showed up, that whole season was so abusive to the audience, I felt. Yes. It just, you can't beat the characters you love to a pulp and never give them a win. It was just kind of like you were just seeing your favorite characters never win. And this Negan was this, he was a villain that was the villain can never be unconquerable. If you create a villain that's unconquerable, then there's no hope. And that's what I felt in Walking Dead. And then I stopped watching. I hadn't seen it since that last season. Yeah, at the very end,
I was a comic book Walking Dead person. So I read all the comic book.
Yeah.
And the comic book is easier to digest because it's not as much story. You know what I mean? Even though it takes place, there's just not as much of it. It's not as much. So Negan's great. I love Negan in the comic book. You're absolutely right, though. He's like undefeatable. He's always two steps ahead. He always finds a way out. He's definitely a tricky character. I think it's kind of the Lost syndrome as well there. When Lost got into those middle years and it just didn't feel like they were allowed to move forward.
They jumped the shark. They jumped the shark. If we can go back to the old concept of jumping the shark.
Absolutely.
For anybody who doesn't know what jump the shark actually means, it's from an old episode of Happy Days when Fonzie literally jumped the shark in his motorcycle. Yeah. And we all said,
okay, you've gone too far.
I think the season before it was a cliffhanger episode, and the season before he jumped like a bunch of barrels, right? That was fine. So in the next episode, next year they topped it. He was in LA. He jumped some sharks. They were doing the whole Evel Knievel thing. It was just bizarre. So
that's where Jump the Shark comes from.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But yeah, it's really interesting in regards to television, because I've consumed obscene amounts of television in my lifetime, and now this last year, I mean, we just literally just go searching. Like we just caught up with This Is Us and watched all of This Is Us, like, and cried a lot. but it's so
the pilot is in my book, so
such an amazingly written, shot show to be able to work multiple timelines, the same characters at different ages, the plotting that's involved with that.
Yeah,
it is on something I've really on a whole other level. There's never been a show like it.
The pilot is a great example too of what people should be doing in their pilots.
Yes,
because not to spoil it, but it's been out a while and it's the first
episode. Spoiler alert! If everyone doesn't want to know, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's absolutely. So This Is Us. It does this thing where it's kind of a mystery. You don't realize how the characters are totally connected. So you're doing the math the whole episode. And then in the very final seconds of it, it shows you how they're all connected. And it does this magic trick.
And it blows your mind.
So you could just watch the pilot episode of This Is Us, turn it off, and sort of be satisfied with the show. It's like a mini movie unto itself. It's really a great episode.
And
it was a movie, by the way. It started as a movie.
Script. Did it? Oh, did the script start as a movie? I've never read it, but
I know it did.
But that's the thing, and that technique they use constantly throughout the series. They'll be introduced to brand new characters, and weird time frames. You don't even know what historical time they're in.
Much like Lost.
Right.
Blew our minds when they did it.
Yeah, you're just like, what's going on? And then you just like these weird characters. And then at the end, just like, and then my wife and I would be sitting there going like, who are these people? Like, how are they connected? Like, where is this line going to, when are they going to meet? And you're just like, oh, and I don't want to ruin it, but I just saw the one with the guy with the internet, who helped start the internet. And there was like the whole series. You saw this family and going through it. And there's one of the guys who actually did the internet and created FaceTime and has how they connected and all that stuff. I was just blown away. I was like, oh, that's brilliant. It was so well, I mean, one of the best written shows on television currently, I think.
No, and like I said, my book also breaks down a bunch of pilots. That's one of them. There's a whole bunch in the book. I tried to give something for everybody. I have Rick and Morty's pilot.
Do you have Breaking Bad?
I didn't do Breaking Bad. Here's the reason I didn't. I tried to only do, first of all, a lot of people have done Breaking Bad.
Right.
And I mentioned Breaking Bad in my character section. There's a whole big thing about it. But I tried to only do shows that weren't yet canceled.
Or finished.
Canceled is a rough word. But I tried to do shows that we'd get another season next year. It was strategic.
Fair enough.
The longevity of the book.
So, right, exactly. So you're not going back to Sopranos.
Exactly. And then I think they announced a week later, This Is Us will end next year. But still, I have 1 year before it will be.
This is news to me. They're ending it next year.
Breaking news. Though my wife and I have a theory that maybe one of these spinoff characters will just become some new iteration of This Is Us, like a new family or something like that.
Of course.
They'll spin one off.
They could absolutely spin that off and continue down.
Same model, different family. Different stories.
Oh, yeah. You could absolutely, absolutely, absolutely do that. Now, one question I had you. You talk about a beat sheet. How do you actually use a beat sheet in creating in television? Because I know how to do it in film, but how do you do it in television?
Sure. So what I did in the TV, and honestly, my experience comes from the Blake Snyder beat sheet. I teach college students. I've taught beat sheets and stuff. So I know it really well. And in recent years, a lot of my students come and say, hey, I don't want to write a feature. I want to do a pilot. Can I do it in your class? And I've I've allowed them to do it. And over the years, I've learned some tricks. I've learned how it works and how it doesn't. How a lot of people that use the Save the Cat Beat Sheet. Now, first I'll describe what the Save the Cat Beat Sheet is, I guess. The Save the Cat Beat Sheet is kind of this template that it spells out what should happen when in a movie, is the most crass way of saying it. So just as an example, I'll go through the first act just to give you a quick example. You start with an opening image. That's like page one, the first thing. And it's usually some thematic image that shows, captures the thematic or how the world is before the story starts. Usually it's bookended with a closing image on the end. And you'd be amazed in a film if you took opening and closing image of your films to see how there's a certain poetry there, how there's a certain bookendedness there. So anyway, opening images first, then you usually get a setup. The setup is all the things you'd think. It's like the character's homework and play, your main character, who your main character is, what their life is like before the story starts. And that's the setup. And then you get to the catalyst, which is this lightning bolt moment that comes in. Like it's Peter Parker being bit by a spider. It's a meteorite crashing into the earth. It's some often random coincidence, some crazy thing that starts the story. It's meeting the person you'll fall in love with in a rom-com. It's whatever that thing is. And that's the catalyst. And that happens on page 12, according to Save the Cat, the first book of a feature film. And it goes on and on like that. There's a midpoint. That's like, you know, at your 50% mark. There's the All Is Lost, which happens about 75% in. That's the worst thing that could happen. That's Obi-Wan Kenobi getting killed or your mentor dying or, mm-hmm. you know, that point where you go into this woe is me thing because something horrible happened. Then the Dark Night of the Soul and the finale and everything else. So the 15 beats of the Save, there's 15 beats in the Save the Cat Beat Sheet. You can get his book and check those out. They're in my book. I completely describe Save the Cat. You can skip over the original book and just go to my book.
I mean, I'm sure the Save the Cat people will not be happy with that, but yes. No, I'm joking. No, there's a lot. There's a lot you could get in both.
You can do it either way.
Either way, yeah. You can get a lot. You can get a lot of both.
Either way. I'm sure Amazon has a buy two for cheap price right now.
Absolutely.
In the whole world.
Absolutely.
That's the Save the Cat people calling me right now on the phone, I think.
I understand. I understand.
That's the beat sheet. It's just kind of this thing. It's kind of like a fill in the blank. And again, these are all the most crass ways of saying it. It's a kind of fill in the blank template that you can go through and say, once I have this done, I'll have an outline for a movie. If I fill out all these sections, I'll have an outline for a movie. The problem is, and by the way, there's a Save the Cat Writes a Novel book that's hugely popular. Because those people are even, when I say those people, I'm one of them, novel writers, are even more resistant to somebody telling them, you know, here's a template than film people are. And it's hugely popular in the novel world. And it's the exact same template, by the way, because the template is really just a template on how to tell a good story. And it's really an adaptation of things that came before it.
Writer's Journey,
Aristotle,
or Joseph Campbell.
Journey, Sid Field, all those things. It's very similar to all of those, but it has its own nuances and its own way of speaking the language. Its own language. It's a language, sort of.
Now, with opening, like an opening scene of a pilot or a film for that matter, I love, one of the reasons I love, I mean, Breaking Bad arguably is probably one of the best written shows of all time. That pilot though, it's a masterpiece. It really is. You give another 15 minutes and it's one of the best independent films ever made. if you do it, the opening scene, what's your feeling on? Cause with the templates that you're laying out, the beat sheet you're laying down, the opening of that scene, and I'm a big fan of this, the opening of that movie is the end. And I love doing that because the audience is like, wait a minute. They're asking questions while you're going through it. Yes. And it's very powerful as a storytelling technique. Is that work inside the beat sheet somewhere?
It does. That one, and I'm trying to remember Breaking Bad. Cause while I remember the beginning, like I get mixed up later because it starts blending in with the other one.
So it was when he comes out, it's like him coming out in his underwear in the middle of the desert.
He does the Blair Witch video.
Right, that whole thing. And then I think it ends with him pointing the gun at the camera, and then we cut to, you know, a week or two later or earlier or something like that.
So I never remember the end of it because it blends with the whole season. I remember the beginning.
So my understanding, if I remember correctly, because I didn't just watch it yesterday, I think we catch up to that moment and then we continue. So that's generally it never ends at that moment. It generally is like a place where you pick up and then you keep going. So it's kind of like a really nice engine.
I was going to say, in a purist sense, then it is a perfect opening and closing image because we're bookending. You know, you're right. Opening and closing on the same kind of thing. It's just that kind of thing. One thing I realized when I watched a ton of television shows getting ready for this book, I found some things that a lot of shows did. And there's a thing I call the opening pitch. And it feels like the first 2 minutes, that teaser scene of almost every show, is almost like something you could show up to an executive's office and just show them that 2 minutes, like say, look, this is our show. What do you think? You know, what questions do you have? Breaking Bad does it in more of that teaser sort of way. Like, here's the coolest thing. We're going to give you mysteries and stuff to think about. Like, how did this guy in his underwear and in this car in the desert and drugs and all that stuff. So they do it in that way. But something like The Mandalorian, for example, mm-hmm. it gives you this mini movie at the beginning where it shows his tools. It shows how he fights. It shows it gives you Star Wars, Star Wars, Star Wars. And you could just show that, you know, imagine if they showed that to us on YouTube, just that first, you know, that first teaser section. In that case, it's longer than 2 minutes. If they showed you that, you'd be like, I'm in. I'm in. And the opening pitch, a lot of them are in character driven shows like Insecure, or even Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is one of my favorite shows. A lot of times you get the main character just talking, like here's who I am. I'm just going to pitch you me. So Insecure, that starts with her pitching herself to a bunch of kids, and like it pulls back and she's talking to kids in a school and they're like, what? You know, you're going too deep here. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, she's at her wedding and she's giving her wedding speech. And she kind of pitches her heart, like who she is, and you see why she's funny, and it's like a stand-up routine. And you could almost just put that, like, here's who she is, and to an executive on the desk, and be like, that's who she is. So this opening pitch thing is something I definitely saw in the teasers, where you get that first 2 minutes to just kind of lean forward and say, this is our show. We're going to show it to you. Rick and Morty, the first 2 minutes of that is a random Rick and Morty adventure. It's almost like a James Bond thing, sort of like the kid gets woken up. They get taken on a spaceship. There's a bomb or something going off. It's Rick and Morty in 2 minutes. It's like an episode of Rick and Morty in 2 minutes. So you find that this happens a lot in pilots. Like that first 2 minutes they use so perfectly. And even in shows like network shows, like Blackish was another show I analyzed. Blackish is like a montage, but it has the main character giving his point of view, like what kind of the Blackish thing means to him. And it's basically an overview of the whole show. It's like a teaser trailer for the whole entire show. Yeah. So anyway, that's what I noticed about the opening pitch.
So you also talk a little bit about the wonky laws of pilot physics. What is that?
Well, in some ways that's there. It's two parts. In some ways, it's my catch-all for all these weird things like the opening pitch. Like there was another thing I noticed I called the whiff of change stated. So in pilots, you usually don't have full character arcs, but there's usually a change in almost all pilots. That might happen in episode 2, 3, because if you changed a character in every episode, it would be weird by, you know, the end of the season. It would be like they keep changing. But most pilots change the character in some small way, like to make a commitment. So, there are some spoilers here for – I'll give you a couple quick spoilers. For The Mandalorian, I think most people know at the end of
it's,
that.
It's on them if they haven't seen it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. But at the end of that, you have this bounty hunter who lives by a code. and he's touching fingers with Baby Yoda. You know, it's like there's some change in the world that this bounty hunter is now going to protect. It's this minor change. And it usually happens around the last scene. But in other shows like Justified or something, mm-hmm. an older show,
Christian,
you get the character literally asking a question, was I justified, at the end of the show, like in a shooting. In shows like Barry, which is one of my favorites, and I cover in the book with a beat sheet. At the end of that, somebody comes up to him and they say, you know, I'm an actor. And he goes, I'm an actor too. He's gone from a hitman to an actor at the end of the show. And he states it. He actually says it. It's amazing how many shows you'll see now when you watch at the end of the pilots, they say what the change is. They verbalize it.
So they actually – so the character – so for – to use as an example, you start off – James Bond starts off in the pilot as a mild-mannered whatever. Right. And then at the end of the pilot, I am now a secret agent. And then the show takes off from there. Now this is his adventures as a secret agent. And, of course, he does change hopefully – throughout the series, somewhat depending on the show, obviously, because some of these procedural shows, these characters never change.
But you got it exactly right. So whatever his arc is in that first episode, which kicks off the show, and it's not always, this is why it's wonky, but it happens so often that I wonder if a memo went out, because you'll see it so often. But I think what it really points to is when you're writing your own pilots, while a TV show doesn't change a character, you know, every episode, your pilot should. Your pilot should have that movement. And the reason I think that's the case, your pilot almost needs to be cathartic by itself. It needs to almost stand alone a little bit. Like you could just go back to watch that Mandalorian episode and say, oh, Baby Yoda and this and that. And you could watch it almost in a vacuum. And never watch another thing again. It has a beginning, middle, end. There's a change in the character. You get the feeling. It's a pitch for the show. You're like,
there could be continuing adventures is the thing. Absolutely. So the story itself solid. And when he touches Baby Yoda, arguably Mandalorian could just, you could stop right there and go, well, obviously he just returned the Baby Yoda to the proper people and that's the end of the story. Or –
yeah, I call it the whiff of change as opposed to a character arc. It's not total character arc. It's usually a question. And in a movie, I think it's very equivalent in a movie to when the character commits to that first act break. In the first act break, a lot of times, like Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, the whole time he's like, I can't go. I got to help with the blue milk farm or whatever he's doing.
It's a
blue milk farm. I think that would have been a lot.
I actually like the blue milk farm as well.
When I reboot it, it's going to be a blue milk farm. They're going to have blue cows. It's going to be there. So by the time his parents his aunt and uncle are killed and realizes and his home's burnt, he kind of looks and he's like, he has that slight whiff of change. He's going on an adventure. Now, the only thing I'd say to a pilot, they almost say what the change is. They almost verbalize it. That's the amazing thing. But usually there's that slight change where they've gone from moisture farmer to adventurer by the end, and they make some commitment. And that'll be the rest of the series. That'll be the season you're watching.
And Mandalorian did it so beautifully because they did it without words. They did it with an image.
Yeah.
And it was like this hard ass, just militant samurai of the universe for a moment softened when he saw and connected with this little creature who we all just were like, our minds exploded when we saw Baby Yoda. And you're just like, oh, this character's changed forever just because of – and that motion of him touching the finger, all of that is – like I'm getting chills. Damn it. Damn you, John Favreau. But it's true, though.
By the way, Mandalorian pilot is also broken down in my book. It was one of the ones I chose.
Smart.
To backtrack to the thing you said, Mandalorian has a hint – of serialization for a streamer. It definitely has a Mission of the Week quality, kind of a throwback to the 80s almost.
It actually has like an A-team-ish vibe to it.
it has a serialized story running on the higher level.
Sure.
But and it gets more serialized like toward the later episodes in each season. But it definitely has like
–
we got to help this person.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's literally like every episode like, okay, we're going to go break this guy out of jail. Okay, we're going to go to this moon and we're going to go do this. Or we got to go to this base that we got to sneak into. Like every week it's something. And it literally leads itself to the next episode. Absolutely. It's so beautifully done. Like what do we got to do now? Oh, well. Well, actually, it doesn't lead to the next episode, but it starts. So a lot of times he'll just be like flying off into space. Right. And then the new episode like – pick him up from space. Oh, we're going to land on this planet. New adventure.
We need some fuel. We need some blue milk.
We need some blue milk. Oh, look, it's Seven Samurai. Okay, let's do Seven Samurai now on this planet. And it's great. No, it's a wonderful show. I wanted to ask you something, though. With television, the old school way of television where you had commercial breaks, there was a very specific style of writing, plot point breaks, that had to hit because commercials. So it's generally like a five act. I think it was a five act.
It really depends on the network you're on and the show. It's funny. They're actually heavily negotiated things. So if you're Vince Gilligan, you might be like, I only want four. There's no way I'm doing five. You know what I mean? And AMC's like, Walking Dead is 10 or whatever. You know, Walking Dead is a ton. They just do it, boom, boom, boom. They put commercials all over the place.
And he could say, we don't have zombies, damn it, so we're doing four.
That's right. That's right. And then something like Mad Men, I think the thing with that show was the showrunner said, I'm not writing them in. You figure it out. And they had to figure it out. They had to go in and put ads in. So they come kind of abruptly in Mad Men.
But when writing a pilot, let's say there's many more streamers than there are network.
My advice to people, and people take this the hard way in some ways, I don't think they like hearing this necessarily. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to write act outs at all on your pilots anymore. You can just totally forget about that for now. Once you're hired or once they buy your script, then you worry about it. But nobody's judging your script on where you put your act outs or even if you know what they are. They're purely judging it on story. Almost everybody I talked to said, yeah, don't worry about the act outs. However, there are some people that like putting them in just because it's kind of like when people put smash cut in their feature. You know, it just feels something like smash cut to interior gym night, you know. And I think people like to put them in for that dramatic moment. Like it's almost like what I say in my book. I always say you could write to them. And I feel like if you replace them with dun, 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 you know, in your head and that works for you, then feel free to write to them because they serve a valid, they serve as a valid inspiration to write to these big cliffhanger moments and have five of those in your script and stuff like that. Like if that inspires you to write a page turner, then put them in. Or put them in and then take them out in the end, if that inspires you. But you don't need them. And if they give you any anxiety at all, like where should they go or should they be here or there, then I'd say take them out. I've written for shows that have them. And it's funny, when you get to production, that's when you get like the network version. Like on our network, we do it this way. And they're very specific. Like when you're writing a pilot, the advice is you can put them wherever you want. So act one, it can be on page 12. It can be on page 10. It's your call. 20, you make it up. You're your own network when you write a pilot. But once you get into a phase where AMC buys your pilot, they have certain network rules. Like it might be your act one act out must come between page 10 and 15. Mm-hmm. And if it's on page 15, you have to give at least 6 pages before the next one. Or, you know, they have certain rules that are unique network to network. I would advise not worrying any bit about that until they pay you to worry about it. Because you don't know if your show's going to be on Netflix or Amazon Prime where they don't have ads, or Hulu, which has ads but sort of doesn't, or, you know, wherever.
It kind of does. If you pay, you don't. It's the wild, wild west. Like before, I mean, for decades, it was pretty much the three, then four networks, and television was just written away, and that was just the way it was. And then all of a sudden, now it's literally 1,000 different ways and 1,000 different approaches and 1,000 different things that you could never – can you imagine getting Breaking Bad on the air? It just never would have happened. Never would have happened. You know, shows like that would have never been able to get on anywhere else. Or Mad Men, you know, like that.
That
doesn't seem like a good – well, Breaking Bad's arguably one of the worst pitches in history, and Vince Gilligan says that. It's like, it's a horrible, horrible pitch.
I remember I didn't watch Breaking Bad at first. I
mean, me neither.
Yeah, I was like, it sounds like Weeds. It's like Weeds a little bit. And I was like, I'm not going to – I loved Weeds, but I was like, I saw Weeds. I like her. I'm not sure that I like him.
I caught it all the way up to the last five episodes. So the last five or six episodes I watched live.
Okay.
But we binged all the way up until then. So this is a great way to finish it.
I think that was season two. I picked up on it. Somewhere in season two, up on it.
It's just
but,
I mean, and then it is what it is. Can you explain what a board is, and how do you use a board in the pilot? Is there a way to use the board in the pilot?
So the board. This is what's kind of interesting about Save the Cat. So Save the Cat is mostly known for this 15-point beat sheet, right? But it introduced a lot of other cool concepts, like write your log line before you write a script, you know, and things like that. The genres that we mentioned briefly. But one of the big things it had from day one was this thing called the board. And in a film, basically what the board is, it actually translates really well to television because they use boards like crazy in television. A board is just an index, a cork board. It could be a digital board. It's whatever you want to make it. But usually it's it's those index cards that you can buy in a pack. You get them at the grocery store. I think I buy $1 is 100 cards, perfect for a movie or a TV show. So for $1, you can have your movie. Mm-hmm. By the way, Save the Cat has pre-printed ones now. They have like little fancy things to fill things out.
And I've seen Post-it notes. People use Post-it notes as well.
I use Post-it notes. I'm a Post-it note guy. It's just they're more disposable. I don't have a good board, so I just
use Post-it notes. You just put it on the wall. You can pop it in, pop it out.
Basically, you write your scenes down on it. So, you know, let's say we were doing Breaking Bad. It might be like confessional scene. We might just jot down the basics of it. Confessional scene in the desert. Walt thinks he's about to die. That'll be first card. Tack that up on the board. You know, second scene, saddest breakfast in the world. He turns 50, bacon, blah, 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 whatever. We tack that up on the board. And basically we construct an entire show with these index cards. In a film, Blake's guidance was 40 cards. By the way, this part was revolutionary to me. Even though I knew him, he told me this, and I didn't know what he was talking about. So when we were doing that script, he said, I think we're ready. I think we have our beat sheet. Let's do a 10-20-10. And I was like, what's a 10-20-10? I just assumed all writers, he made this up. I mean, he made it up. Let's do a 10-20-10. So what a 10-20-10 was 40 index cards. That's what he considered a feature film. 10 were act one, 20 were act two, and then 10 were act three. So act two, as you see, is twice as big as the other two. It's four acts. That's the dirty secret of feature filmmaking.
10, 10, 10, 10.
There's like act two is 2A, you know, act two is, you know, you get 2A and 2B and they get split into twist. TV works the same way. You'd quirk all those 40 up, 10, 10, 20, 10, or 10, 10, 10, 10, four times. Mm-hmm. TV works the same way, but there's a lot less beats. And it just depends. The big thing I found in adapting Save the Cat, it adapts fine to writing a pilot. It adapts great. I use it myself to write pilots. But what it doesn't adapt to, and what I've pulled away, is the beat sheet is more like a to-do list and less like a this must happen. Page 12. This much happened at page 30. Because what you find is a show like The Mandalorian, that opening pitch, that cool scene in the beginning where he captures the person and I think there's a monster that attacks him in the desert. He flies away and they do the carbon freezing and all that stuff. That's like 12 minutes long. It's 12 minutes. So if you were doing it 10-20-10 and that was just your opening pitch, you'd blow up. It's like sucking up so much juice of your timeline that you'd be in big trouble. But what I found in television is they spend time where they need to spend time. A lot of times in pilots, it's the setup, because they need to set up characters. They need to set up character arc. They need to set up worlds. They need to set up all this stuff. So they need all that time for the setup, the first act. But then sometimes, Mandalorian's a perfect example. The fun and games section, which is the first part in Save the Cat terms, fun and games is the first part of Act Two. It's usually the promise of the premise. So if you were seeing a movie, it's like trailer moments. It's like the monster went wild or the people are on an adventure or something like that. But in The Mandalorian, because they do all that cool stuff in the beginning, it's really small, like fun and games. Like he ends up there, he has to tame the beast, that creature, I think, to ride.
Right.
And him and the Ugnaught go off on the adventure, and that's kind of all they do for fun and games. It's really small, and the midpoint twist and stuff like that happen afterwards. So they, in television, you as a writer have to pick and choose what gets the space. All the beats get hit, but they don't necessarily get all the space like in a regular feature where you say, you know, it's very rigid in a feature. It's like 10 for the first act, 20 right. for the second act, 10 for the fourth. In a Save the Cat television show, it could be like I got 5 for the setup, I have 3 for Act Two, I have 3 for Act 2B, and then I have 2 for the finale or something. You might do some weird combination, and I give a lot of guidance to that. It's sort of where true television writing comes into play, because television writers often in writers' rooms, if you Google writers' rooms and you look up the Breaking Bad writers' rooms, what you'll see is these boards. You'll see note cards and boards. They live and breathe off note cards and boards, even more than feature writers do. It's really how most of them break story.
Now, do you need a show Bible?
You don't need a show Bible. You don't need a show Bible. I do have a section where I tell you how to write a sort of a Bible light, which is a pitch document. That's what most people have. Most people have the 1-2 punch of their pilot and some kind of 5-10 page pitch document that, you know, it sets up what season one will look like in a very high level, like a couple pages at most. It sets up who all the characters are. It tells what your personal connection is to the story. And that's the pitch document. But the truth of pitching television is usually done face-to-face. It's very rarely done, like, submit your pitch document to us. I have you do that for preparation, but also to prepare in case you're called. Like, somebody reads your pilot, and it's time. They're like, hey, we're bringing you in. You know, come on. You're ready to go. If you do the pitch document I described in the book, which was given to me over many years from managers, studio execs, all that, I'm kind of giving you the one they gave me. You'll be ready to pitch.
Nice. Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What are 3 pilots everyone should read?
3 pilots everyone should read. Wow. This should be an answer that's I'm rock solid ready. The truth is I'm trying to be original, but Breaking Bad's pretty darn good. I just can't get away from it.
Right. I mean, it's like Chinatown is Chinatown. I mean, you're going to have to. Godfather is Godfather. I mean, you got to read it.
Exactly. The other one that comes to mind, and it's not in my book because it's an older one, is The Shield. I think The Shield is a great pilot. It has this great ending that throws you into the next week. It gives you everything about those characters, but it also gives you a beginning, middle, end story. So it feels kind of procedural, but then it also feels like it's got a continuing story. You want to watch the next episode. You want to get to the next episode. And I'll take one from my book. One of the ones I really liked from my book was Barry's pilot. It just fits really well. It does a really efficient job of being exactly what it is, telling a surprising beginning, middle, end story, and setting up next week, all the while being thematic character driven. So I'm a big fan of the Barry one. I can't remember if I read the Barry one. I think I did. I think it's out there. I think you can get it because I think
can get it as well.
I think it's out there.
Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
Honestly, I mean, this is no joke. If you can swing it, television is the way. And honestly, that's why I wrote this book, because my students are going to television. I've been going to television for the last few years. Think television. Think about these pilots. Try to get yourself a good pilot. The other advice that I always give is you kind of have to prepare. You have to make yourself better as much as you have to make your work better, because it's a grind. Like, we went over my history in the beginning of this. If I told you it was going to take you 7-8 years before you get in the WGA, you got to be ready for that. You know, you got to be ready. And the way I got ready for it was I learned how to write 5 scripts or 6 scripts a year, 10 scripts a year. I also had to understand failure and understand patience and understand all that stuff. So I'm a big fan of figure out how you're going to endure the long journey, as opposed to just find a way through the door. Like, set yourself up so that you can be persistent. So you can be persistent over a 20-year period and not like a wild person over a 1 month or 1 year period. Set yourself up for the long term is what I'm saying.
And what's the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Wow, that's a tough one. Because the lesson that took me the longest to learn in the film business is probably something I'm still needing to learn. That's the hard part about that question.
Yeah, I get that answer quite a bit. I'm like, I'm still learning it. I'm like, but there's always something. For me, it's patience. It's always been patience for me. It's gonna take twice as long, if not longer, than you ever expected it to be.
Sadly, I've learned patience. Not that it makes me happy, but I've learned that. Honestly, it feels like I've just been ground down to the numbness of patience. You know what I mean? It's like I'm so numb.
You have no choice in the matter. It's an acceptance of the inevitable. That's all it is. When you're like, I'm a patient person. No, you've just accepted the realities of the world. And in our business, my God, nothing moves fast. Nothing.
Nothing moves fast. And sometimes that slow move, like right now I have, 3 projects out there. One is getting notes at a super slow pace. The other is trying to attach a director at a molasses-like pace because they're going to big directors. And the other is trying to attach an actor at a molasses. So when I say attach an actor, it's like a situation where you send a script out, it goes to the agent. The agent takes a month to get back. Then they say yes or no. They usually say yes. And then it takes 2 months for the actor, and you're waiting all that time to go to the next actor. So it's like the slow slog of attachment.
When I'm doing projects now, I think of it as like it's a 3 to 4 year project. Like I'm just I walk in knowing that it's going to be a 3 year. Like, oh yeah, in 3 or 4 years, it's going to get where I need it to be. But
so this isn't really one that I'd say. So my lesson in regards to that, like how I've learned to deal with that. It's not a lesson. It's a weird lesson because I don't want to put pressure on people to do it this way. I've learned that the only way I can stomach that, the only way I can have patience, is by spinning lots and lots of plates. That's why I'm doing Save the Cat Rates for TV, while I'm writing a pilot, while I'm pitching a TV show, while I'm reading a novel. If I don't have 10 plates spinning at a time in some way, I mean, one of them could be an old script that's out there that's spinning. You know what I mean? It could be like a 5-year-old script that I've kind of given rebirth to and sent to somebody. But if I don't have 10 things out there, I start getting anxiety. And that's part of what I'm saying for the long haul. Like, think about the stuff you're doing now may not pay off for like 7 years. I've had a bunch of scripts that didn't sell for like 6 or like I had managers that or people that would say, I don't think this one's very good. And then it sold like 7 years later. And it's not that they were wrong. It was just, the market wasn't its time. Yeah. The market changed. So get those things going. Think about them long term. But the only way I find to deal with failure, not failure, but rejection and the slow slog is to have so many things that today I'm talking to you and I'm talking about Save the Cat Rights for TV. I'm not thinking about all the rejections that are probably piling up in my email right now. I'll think about those once we hang up and then I'll see them. But I have like 50 things going on, but right now I can only focus on this thing. So it's a great way. The best way to, you know, stem off that rejection, to stem off that impatience is to start something else, to keep moving, to keep spinning plates. So I'm a juggler, by the way. So plate spinning is my
great advice. I do the same thing. I actually have too many plates spinning to the point where it gets a little out of hand. And people are like, "How are you doing that?" I'm like, "I'm just built to do that. I have 1,000 things going on 1,000 times." And they're like, "How do you put out?"
It's a vicious circle. It can be weird because you probably couldn't stop it now.
People are like, "How do you put out three to four podcasts fresh every week with four shows or something like that, or five shows and something like that?" And I'm like, I mean, if it was just one, I'd be bored. I could do one episode a week in my sleep. Five is challenging.
Are you telling me I'd have to sit with my own thoughts for a while?
No, you can't have any of that. No, stop that. That's not possible. And very last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Yeah, this one, it's so funny. I keep changing this one for some reason. All my movies, by the way, are ones I've seen in theater as a kid. Like, they're my favorites.
Right? Fair enough.
And unfortunately, I'm heavily in the Spielberg, Lucas.
Fair enough. Hey,
I was in that. Right? So I apologize for being lame, as I'm about to be. So Raiders of the Lost Ark is my number one favorite. Now I start switching. These are the ones I start switching back and forth. Back to the Future, I'll put it number two. I love Back to the Future. I like the mix of genres in the comedy. And then the third one is the one, sometimes it's RoboCop. Sometimes it's Evil Dead 2. Sometimes it's nice. There's all these weird ones I mix back and forth. I'm trying to remember one I said the other day. And sometimes it's Star Wars, the first Star Wars. We don't call it A New Hope in this house.
No, obviously not. It's just Star Wars. Yes. Yes.
So it's and sometimes it's Aliens. And I mix and match all of those. Good. I saw them all in the theater.
All good.
And I can't. It's strange because even Back to the Future sometimes slides back to three and something else is like, and E.T. is another one. I mean, there's so many Jaws. But today I'm going to go with I'll just go with Star Wars because that'll make
sense. Fair enough. I mean,
you've got a Mandalorian.
You don't have to go too far with me. Now, where can people find out more about you and where can they buy the book?
Oh, sure. Probably the best place to see me is on Twitter. I'm at Jamie_Nash. I respond there. I do a lot of goofy messages. Sign up, follow me. A lot of Save the Cat kind of stuff too. A lot of writer stuff. So if you're into writing stuff, I'm definitely involved in the writing community on Twitter. So please follow me. I'd love to have any interaction. You can buy the book on Amazon. That's the usual go-to place, but you can buy it anywhere that sells books. It's in a couple Barnes and Nobles. It's funny. I'm constantly tracking, like, when's it going to show up at my Barnes and Noble? Like, it's in like four places in Maryland, where I live, but it's not in the one that's right across the street from my house. I'm kind of angry about it. I want it there. But you can buy it. You can buy it anywhere you buy books. And the audiobook is about to drop this week. I don't know, this week. Amazon says 30 days and
it takes forever. Thanks for having
me. Yeah, 30 days runs out like this week or next week. So soon. Soon will be an audiobook if you prefer that. And some people do.
Jamie, thank you so much. This has been a very educational conversation. I really feel that you were channeling Blake when you were writing this book because a lot of the things that you're saying ring so Save the Cat in the way that you're presenting the information in a very simple, easy to understand method, which is what Save the Cat is so brilliant and what Blake was so brilliant at doing. So congratulations on the new book, and hopefully it'll help a few writers out there. So thanks again, my friend.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to thank Jamie for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get Save the Cat rights for TV, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/120. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com and leave a honest and good review, hopefully, for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.